From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, GM will shutter five plants, including Detroit Hamtramck and Warren Transmission.
They're not technically being closed. It's interesting, if you look at the wording here, they're what they call unallocated, meaning they don't have a product after 2019.
A talk with Detroit Police Chief James Craig.
The men and women here are exposed to so much more when you compare to many of the other major cities across America.
John U. Bacon on Michigan's terrible day in Columbus.
Ohio State picked a very good time to play its best game of the year. And Michigan picked a very bad time to play its worst game of the year.
And Susan Whitehall with her new book on Joni Mitchell.
She just didn't always get the respect, the attention that she deserves. But she is getting it late in her life, late in her career.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. General Motors is making big headlines today as it announces it will end production at plants in Detroit and Warren, Michigan, Lordstown, Ohio, and Oshawa, Ontario. To break this down, we welcome back Stateside contributor and Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. So, Daniel, are these plants being closed?
They're not technically being closed. It's interesting, if you look at the wording here, they're what they call unallocated, meaning they don't have a product after 2019. And 2019 also happens to be a contract year with the UAW. So this is going to be subject to negotiations next year. I don't think there's any question about that, as the union tries to scramble for getting product allocated into these plants.
Okay, so I guess explain that a little further, because the headlines all kind of came out this morning, and it's, you know, GM shuttering plants. I'm actually reading the Detroit News, your colleague Nora Naughton, GM shuttering plants in Detroit, Ohio, and Canada. So take us deeper into what this means.
They're sending a couple of messages here, two very, very powerful messages, I think. Number one, they're sending a message to investors and to Wall Street that they are not going to be caught flat-footed as the market continues to turn. And it is not news to anybody out there that trucks and SUVs are the new thing among American consumers. Almost everyone seeing their car sales decline, in some cases precipitously. We've talked on your air earlier this year about what Ford decided to do with essentially going 90% trucks, SUVs, and commercial vehicles in the United States within 2 years.
Right.
Shocking an awful lot of people. Chrysler got out of the car business in the United States basically altogether a couple of years ago. Sergio Marchionne was way ahead of everybody else. What I think GM is saying here is pretty much the same thing. We are going to reallocate our resources to products that are selling, i.e. trucks and SUVs, and also to invest in the kind of technology that we believe we need to have to be competitive in what we call Auto 2.0, mobility, autonomy, self-driving cars, electrification. So not only are they closing these plants, but I think just as big of an announcement is that they confirm they're going to cut 15% of their salaried workforce. Mm-hmm. Those are people that typically earn more dollars than your average union guy or woman working on the line. And so that can have a knock-on effect to the local economy, because a lot of those people tend to be clustered here in Southeast Michigan. So I don't think there's any question but what this is a real signal as the direction General Motors is going. Final thought I would give you is I think they are very determined to do this when the economy is in pretty good shape and their company is in good shape. Historically, General Motors takes these kinds of actions when the wheels are falling off the wagon, proverbially speaking. 2007, 2008 are great examples.
Absolutely.
The hits just kept coming and kept coming. We live in an economy where things can change very quickly because of the speed of the internet. You know, people track their investment portfolios or their 401ks or whatever the case may be, and they can see things going south and they can change their behavior pretty quickly. The days of 20 years ago when things would take 6 months or 3 months for something to trickle through the economy, I think in a lot of ways is gone.
So when we think that there's some 5,600 or so jobs at stake in these plants in Detroit, Hamtramck, Lordstown, and Oshawa, what of those workers? Do they have a crack at jobs at other GM plants, or is this where we're going to be looking at the negotiations with the UAW?
I think that's TBD. Now, my colleague Nora Naughton reporting this morning that I think they've been told that the workers in these plants will get cracks to work in other facilities. Now, if you're in Lordstown in Northeast Ohio, you know, the next closest plant is, I don't know, Detroit maybe. it's not a very convenient commute. We've seen this happen before historically where people can bid on work at other plants, but that can be very stressful in terms of moving, or if you're in Metro Detroit, it might be a little more palatable and there may be more options for you if you're in Metro Detroit. So I think it really depends upon where these folks are. You know, in Canada, that's a different story. General Motors has been big in Oshawa for a very long time. They've got multiple lines up there. I'm not exactly sure what will be the fate of that. There will be other rules and laws that will pertain to that because it's happening in Canada with a different union.
We should also note GM's closing its transmission plant in Warren as well. Mm-hmm. So what's behind that?
They're consolidating. We've heard this before in the industry, but where customers can't feel it or see the difference, they want to commonize as much as they can. And a lot of times people don't know the difference between transmissions. Maybe they can go and cut the number of transmissions. They need less capacity to do that. That means that they're going to be investing more in electrified powertrains, mm-hmm. which I don't think there's any question they are coming. The final point here on people that I think is important to note here is they're also going to be hiring a lot of people. They're going to be hiring a lot of younger talent, people that are going to be working in emerging technologies that they believe can make them competitive in the next generation of automotive transportation.
Were you surprised by this?
The timing, a tiny bit. I've been talking with my colleagues about this and saying I firmly believe that there was going to be capacity cuts coming, meaning plant closures of some kind. I talked with some ranking people at GM about this and wrote a column in which I kind of speculated that this was coming. No, I'm not, because I think they have made it very clear that they are going to take actions and make decisions. Look, Mary Barra makes decisions unlike any General Motors CEO, and I've covered this company around the world for 25 years. She's very decisive. She was recently at a New York Times talk and somewhere in New York, and my colleague Nora Naughton quoted her as basically saying, when you see a problem, you need to fix it. You need to move to fix it. It doesn't usually get better over time. You know, it's not like a fine wine. It gets worse. And I think one of the things you see with this management team is they recognize certain products are out of favor in the marketplace. They don't expect them to come into favor because they are the trucks and SUVs of a generation ago or even 10 years ago are not what they are today. They're more fuel efficient. They're lighter. They're using different materials. In many cases, they share componentry with what we think of as the classic sedan. So you get some of those kind of ride and handling, but a little bit more capability. So it's just body styles that look different. But the traditional car is clearly falling out of favor, I think, in most manufacturers, with the exception of a few of the Asian manufacturers, are seeing precipitous declines in their car volumes. And they're taking the actions they need to take.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The Big Ten football championship game will be played this Saturday in Indianapolis. To many, this was the year that Michigan was going to be at that game playing. But that embarrassing loss Saturday to Ohio State means the Wolverines stay home, and the Ohio State Buckeyes will play Northwestern for the Big Ten title. Michigan radio sports commentator John Eubanks is here now. 62 points, the most ever scored on Michigan by anyone, anytime, by the Buckeyes, and also the most points scored against a Jim Harbaugh coach team, including his time as coach of Stanford and the San Francisco 49ers, and it happens in the biggest game of the year. Where does this one stand, do you think, on the list of Wolverine losses?
One of the most painful, although, look, there are a lot of painful losses. I mean,
yeah.
The most painful loss was a tie, and that's 73-10-10 tie, of course. The vote takes place, and Ohio State goes to the Rose Bowl instead of Michigan, and Michigan stays home. No bowl games back then. So, look, there's a long list of pain, and any Michigan fan can give you the list.
Well, it seems like basically everything that could go wrong did on Saturday. But in your view, what went most wrong for Michigan?
Look, on one level, it's pretty simple. Ohio State picked a very good time to play its best game of the year, and Michigan picked a very bad time to play its worst game of the year. That's about what it was. Because, look, the Buckeyes a month ago were playing Purdue and got their hats handed to them. In West Lafayette, a place where Eastern Michigan went down and beat the Boilermakers. I forgot what the score was, but it was like 45-20. Just got shellacked. And they just turned around and did it to Michigan, basically. So the offense, Michigan's offense, might have been too conservative, although they scored 39 points, which is damn near a record. And the defense, of course, might have been too aggressive. And Ohio State had a lot of answers for Michigan's defense.
Do you think people wearing maize and blue got a little too caught up in the revenge tour and the buzz about this being their year and getting to the CFP? Did they underestimate Ohio State?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, look, no one thought Ohio State was going to do this. I thought the two possibilities, one a dogfight or two, Michigan blows them out. I did not think it was possible for Ohio State to blow out Michigan. But look, man, I mean, this is still fun. Yeah, it's irrational. Of course they got ahead of their skis, and of course they got too excited and so on. That's what makes it great. The pain is real, sad to say, but it's still a game. And that's part of the fun, in my opinion. Look, few things can make you feel, what did a friend of mine on Twitter say? For those who don't watch college football, how can you feel simultaneously so alive and like you want to die all within the same day? That's the cheap thrill we get from college football.
Well, we stop and you kind of look and realize Michigan finished this season at 10-2 after going 8-5 last year. And the Wolverines are being talked about as having a shot at the Rose Bowl if certain things line up. Mm-hmm. Was this season a success or a failure for Jim Harbaugh?
A dramatic success. And look, I called him at 10-2 in August when you and I were talking.
Yeah.
And that seemed optimistic. A lot of folks were calling them 8-5 again because the schedule was unusually hard, one of the hardest in college football, with your main rivals, Notre Dame, Michigan State, and Ohio State, all on the road, which matters a great deal in college football. You beat Michigan State, Wisconsin, Penn State, all teams that had beaten you last year. You beat them soundly. And you got a great team coming back next year, and you're number three nationwide in academics. So that's supposed to matter.
All right, so let's talk about Michigan State, which had to fight awfully hard to beat Rutgers, the Big Ten bottom dwellers. What did we learn about the Spartans in that game?
They've got a lot of injuries, is what we learned. And it's still true. They're a badly injured team. They're 7-5. They probably would have been 8 or 9 wins without the injuries. They were expected to do a lot better this year at 12th ranked. Now the questions in East Lansing are kind of like the ones in Ann Arbor. Has D'Antonio worn it out, basically? Has he got enough juice left to pull this off? And when Michigan fans are complaining about 3 10-win seasons in 4 years, complain to the Spartans. They would trade for that very readily.
There seems to be even a louder cry for D'Antonio to fix the offense and maybe say goodbye to Dave Warner, the co-offensive coordinator.
And that's justified. The offense has been abysmal this year for Michigan State. The defense usually pretty good, but not always. Look, Harbaugh, the exact same choice last year, a close friend, Tim Drevno, his offensive coordinator, and they've been friends for years. Their wives are friends. This is very difficult to do. He made the switch. It was the right switch. Michigan did score 39 points against a very good Ohio State team. So Michigan's offense is not the problem.
Finally, looking ahead to Saturday's Big Ten Championship, who do you like, Northwestern or Ohio State?
Are you kidding? That's cute.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubagen. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Coming up, singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell turns 75 this year.
You know, she's one of our few female musical geniuses, along with Aretha Franklin and people like that.
We'll hear about a new book highlighting 27 interviews with Joni Mitchell and learn about her early days in Detroit. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Larry Nassar disguised his sexual abuse of hundreds of girls and women as medical treatment. The former doctor would see them in a typical exam room for a scheduled appointment, and often sitting just a few feet away was the victim's mom or dad. This week on the Believed podcast, hosts Kate Wells and Lindsay Smith talk with the parents of Nassar survivors. In this excerpt, we hear from a father, Ted, telling us what it was like to be a parent sitting in Larry Nassar's exam room.
It was almost like you're in awe. You're sitting there, and while he's treating her, you're looking at the walls, and you're seeing all the autographs, and two signed by the Olympians, to Larry, you are the best. Thank you for everything you've done for us. And you're looking at all that, and you're saying, this guy is truly a saint. And everybody loves this guy. He's never met anybody like this in my life.
To Ted, Larry seemed so capable, so skilled.
He would take out the skeleton, and he would say, okay, see this bone here, and that this is what's causing the pain, and we need to align that. So a lot of hands-on massaging, yeah. So I saw him massaging her and this and that, but I never saw him touch her in inappropriate places, never.
But as more victims came forward and Larry was arrested, Ted thought, oh my God, it must be true. Larry must have been abusing these girls. And then, thank God, Larry didn't hurt our daughter.
We believe that he did this to all those innocent girls, but we also believe that he didn't touch our daughter because we had such a great relationship. It was like a family, like he would never touch our daughter.
Listen to all of Believe from Michigan Radio and NPR on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. New episodes are out on Mondays. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Sitting in a park in Paris, France, reading the news and it sure looks bad. They won't give peace a chance.
She is one of music's most interesting singer-songwriters. Joni Mitchell has been honored with 9 Grammys, including an honorary Grammy, during her long career. And now writer Susan Whitehall helps us understand just what Joni was thinking and feeling through the decades. Her new book, Joni on Joni, Interviews and Encounters with Joni Mitchell, is a collection of 27 interviews with Mitchell spanning the years from 1966 to 2014, and it's where we discover the Canadian-born Mitchell has some deep roots in Michigan. Susan Whitehall is a former music writer for the Detroit News and an editor at the legendary Cream magazine. Susan, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Where do you think Joni Mitchell stands in the pantheon of America's singer-songwriters?
Wow. You know, she's one of our few female musical geniuses, along with Aretha Franklin and people like that. And Joni, of course, wrote virtually all of her own material, so this is huge. She just didn't always get the respect, the attention that she deserves. But she is getting it late in her life, late in her career.
I know they just had a big 75th birthday bash for her. Vanity Fair wrote it up, and Hollywood's Biggest and Brightest came out to pay her tribute.
And it's great that she was well enough to enjoy it.
Why not? Why did she not get that respect?
Well, when you look at the times, I discovered this in researching and editing these interviews with her over the years. She was really treated as the Mrs. when she was first interviewed, along with her first husband, Chuck Mitchell. He was the star. In reality, he was a star before she was here in Detroit on the folk scene. But also, there was just a sexism to it, and she was a cute chick. And guys would always say to her, well, you know, why don't you be a model? Why do you want to be a folk singer? You know, it would be so much easier. But then in the same breath, they would ask for her if they could use one of her songs, you know, and they loved her material, although they'd make fun of her, too. It was just the way it was in the 60s. You were not always treated on a par. And she, you know, would wear false eyelashes. She kind of played the game a little bit in the early days until David Crosby told her to cut that out.
And
she kind of adapted the more California look.
Well, let's start with the fact that she grew up in Canada and displayed musical talent at a very early age.
She did. I think her isolation, there wasn't that much to do. There's long winters in Saskatchewan, and she was an only child, and she had polio. I really think that factored into a lot of this. She was alone in the hospital for quite a while, and she'd start singing to herself in the hospital room, and the boy in the next bed would tell her to stop it, and she'd sing louder. So that, she was a creative child because her parents, her mother especially, did encourage it in domestic ways and creative ways. And she had all this time to do all that sort of thing. And this was the pre-TV era when children had to kind of amuse themselves. That helped.
And music did that for her. What brought her to Michigan, to Detroit?
She met Chuck Mitchell, and he was a tall, good-looking guy. That was his first trip to Toronto as a folk singer. That was his first out-of-town trip. And he had been living in downtown Detroit since the early 60s. He's from Rochester, grew up out there. And they met. It was kind of instantaneous, very much of an attraction. And he proposed to her, she says, right away, within hours. She didn't come back with him right away, but she took the train down from Toronto to visit him in Detroit, and she basically didn't leave. They got married. This would be 1965.
When I'm thinking, as I read these interviews and kind of exploring that Chuck and Joni story here, they lived in the Cass Corridor, and they were kind of like an boho it couple, weren't they?
They were, absolutely. There was no other explanation why this couple was being written up in the news and featured in the Free Press as well, because they weren't that well known. Chuck was on the folk scene, and then they became Chuck and Joni on the folk scene at the Chessmate, at the Raven, at the Living End. You know, but that wasn't enough. It was enough. It was enough for them to be the cool kids. And they had that picturesque apartment, and she was making the curtains, and she was very crafty. They were very attractive. And you can see the photos in my book I got from the Detroit News that I always knew were there.
Yeah, and dug them up. But I have to point out, I want to just read the very end of that first Detroit News story, February 1966. I am quoting here. Chuck said, "Joni and I have developed our act. We are not just folk singers now. We do comedy, sing some ragtime, do folk rock. We're ready for the big clubs now." Joni nodded her approval as any dutiful wife would do.
Yep.
Okay. You're a writer. You're an editor. How do you describe that? The tone of those early interviews?
That's why I think it was important to have that in there. 1966, that was a little much even for 66. As a teenager, young teenager, whatever, I would have bridled at that had I read it. I was a Free Press reader at the time.
Yeah.
It's kind of probably the combination of an older male reporter, and Chuck might have been doing most of the talking, and she was nodding. And he kind of assumed she was nodding like a dutiful wife. Now, Chuck says quite the opposite. They had a very feisty Irish marriage, according to him.
Meaning?
And so she was always very outspoken and very tart. And they would argue all night while they were playing cards and smoking and having fun, and just a very lively, passionate kind of affair marriage.
And what fractured the marriage?
I think they were, you know, as she said in the song, he carried me, I had a king, he carried me off to his country for marriage too soon for her. It was right after she had given up her baby into foster care and then later adoption. I think that was a cloud over the marriage because she felt he should have insisted that she bring the baby to Detroit. And he felt it was her decision to make.
Because this was not his baby.
We should hasten to point.
People will understand that when they read your book, Joni on Joni.
She was pregnant by a college boyfriend, art college. And that was a cloud over. And also, she was starting to take off as a songwriter. She was writing her own material.
And she wrote two of her most famous songs while living in Detroit.
More than that. More than those two songs. But yeah, Circle Game and Both Sides Now. She was in a little coffee shop. One of the huddle houses, not too far from Cass or right on Cass. They're gone now. And that's where she did her writing. So not only that, but she had a Motown guy. Chuck found him actually do the sheet music for her songs, which was an important step in order to get her songs covered. He also had her set up a publishing company, which was also vital because she would still be in the folk scene if it wasn't for Judy Collins and others. You know, Tom Rush was the first one covering her songs.
And the seasons, they go round and round, and the pains and ponies go up and down. We're captive on a carousel of time. We can't return, we can only look behind from where we came and go.
When and why did she leave Michigan?
The marriage did start to fracture because she was starting, they had really split the act in two. She never felt that they gelled well as a duo. He was into more of a dramatic acting comedy, as he said in that interview, and she wasn't. She was strictly into it was musical for her. So she started doing her own thing and going off on gigs on her own, and she was getting a lot of attention because of these songs, especially Both Sides Now, Circle Game. So she was having these gigs without him, and there were a couple of affairs, and one notable one was with Leonard Cohen. So Chuck remembers one last fight when she threw a candelabra, I believe it was, at him. He claimed she missed, but that was sort of one of the last fights. But she did come back to Detroit a few times, unbeknownst to him, and she still had a key, and she would have a guy friend help her take some of their treasures out of the apartment, the Verona, all the way five flights up. She would carry stuff down, and Chuck finally had enough of it, and he changed the locks, which she also refers to in the song "I Had a King."
I can't go back there anymore.
I'm talking with Susan Whitehall about her books, Joni on Joni, Interviews and Encounters with Joni Mitchell. Susan edited some on really interviews that people may have never heard before. You dug up some gems. You know, when I think about the arc of her career, what do we learn, Susan, from the interviews about where she saw her place in the music business? And how did that fit with the way the music business, when I'm talking record executives and producers and critics, saw her? Was there a disconnect?
Oh, yeah. And the fact that I was editing this during this the whole Me Too year was not lost on me at all. They were treating her like a commodity, and that she just hated that. She was constantly complaining that the record executives wanted her to look pretty. They wanted a certain demure attitude. She was talking in the 80s when the MTV was going full throttle. She had to do videos and felt that she couldn't do a serious video. She had to do these crazy ones, and she had to look a certain way. So she constantly thought that was wrong and beneath her, and she always had a high opinion of her art, and she wanted to do things for art's sake.
Well, and Joni had some years, and here, like you mentioned, here's the 80s, it's the MTV era. You have Cyndi Lauper, you have Madonna doing their thing that was perfect for video, and you have this poet that had a completely different vision. Who did she respect music-wise? Who influenced her, or who had her respect?
Oh, well, she respected Dylan, despite the fact that the Daily Mail took out of my book all the sleaze and kind of terrible things she said about him, calling him a plagiarist and all that, and saying he adopted his voice from Hillbillies, stole it from Hillbillies. But she also said that positively 4th Street revolutionized songwriting for her, because when she heard it, she was blown away that you could write in such a conversational style, like you're talking to a friend. Mm. She loved that. And in fact, she was always looking to simplify her lyrics and make them like that, make them very direct.
So you're sitting across the table almost having a conversation. You know, interesting, we need to spend a moment talking about her ex-husband, Chuck Mitchell. He's a good, why does he win the Good Sport Award? With you at the Baldwin Library in Birmingham.
Yep, on December 3rd, on that Monday. He's a good sport because she's trashed him over the years, you know, over her giving up her daughter. And, of course, she has a bigger podium than he does in terms of telling the story, which is why I was very happy to do this book, in part to kind of draw open the curtain on their Detroit years and tell his side of it. He has a real interesting viewpoint. And, you know, he was in that apartment with her for 3 solid years in Detroit. And he saw the early songwriting. He saw her gift develop. And he does Circle Game and often another song or two of hers in his own gigs, which he's playing the Greenwood on the 30th here in Ann Arbor. So it's, you know, he's got a mixed, mixed views, and he's got an interesting viewpoint. And I think he's working on his own memoir, too, that he's writing. So he's got his story, and there's very few people that we talk to who saw her before the big California years like that. He saw her take off like a shot. He doesn't think she could have raised her child and done what she did. We wouldn't have Joni Mitchell as we know it had she also been a mother back then. Hard to agree or disagree with that, because from today's viewpoint, women do it all the time. But that's what he feels at the time in 1965. So, yeah, he's a good sport because he'll get up there and he'll talk. And we'll talk about the folk scene in Detroit as well, not just Joni and he. But they were a very important part of that, and that was part of really influenced her. So that apartment was like a crossroads to people like Neil Young. When he would come to town to Detroit to play, he'd stay overnight with them, Gordon Lightfoot and all those guys. That also helped as a springboard for her, because Tom Rush would hear her new songs and say, hey, I like that. I'm going to play that for Judy Collins. I think she might like that. So you can see where Detroit was really key, crucial in her development.
That should be a really, really interesting night. So again, that's Monday, December 3rd, the evening of December 3rd at the Baldwin Library in Birmingham. Well, it's a fascinating book, Joni on Joni, Interviews and Encounters with Joni Mitchell, edited by Susan Whitehall. Who better to do it than you, Susan? Thank you so much for sharing this with us, and it should be really fun doing that event with Chuck on the 3rd.
Yep. I'll be at Page's on the 28th, too, in Detroit.
All right. Thank you so very much.
Thanks.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
They paved Paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved Paradise, put up a parking lot.
Still to come on Stateside, Detroit Police Chief James Craig says he and his officers are working hard to let residents know they are upping their game.
We're not sitting back waiting to try to make things happen, but we're doing it, and people see it, and that's what matters.
That is in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Detroit Police Department wants to recruit new officers from the city's public schools. But here's a problem. You need a driver's license to work for the DPD, and too many kids just don't have them. Enter Detroit Police Sergeant Star Gonzalez. She's seeking to solve this problem through an innovative program called Drive to Thrive. Sergeant Gonzalez, tell us exactly what is Drive to Thrive.
It's a program that we started through our Detroit Public Safety Foundation for our Detroit Public Schools to help our youth receive a driver's license. I don't know if you're aware of this, but they took the program out of the schools many years ago, and unfortunately, the cost of it could cost anywhere up to $600, and our youth is not able to afford this, which enables them to drive, jobs, career opportunities, and everything else.
What was the problem that you saw with recruitment that you thought this program could help solve?
So as I'm recruiting in the high schools, you know, and I'm going around to all the, even the colleges, my local colleges in Detroit and for my Detroit students, and we're trying to get them, you know, to come on the Detroit Police Department. As I go through the requirements, I start losing everybody with the driver's license. And I ask, like, well, why don't you have a driver's license? Or why didn't you get it yet? And sure enough, it's always because the people cannot afford to get their driver's license. Mm-hmm. And it became the norm in our schools. You go around to all of our high schools, and I have 100 students, 100 12th graders that's graduating, and you know, say, who has their driver's license? You know, who's going to meet the qualifications once they graduate? And you might have three people raise their hand. And that's a big issue.
So they get through Drive to Thrive, which you've started at Cody High School, right? Because that's a Detroit Police magnet school?
That was our very first school, was at Cody High School, yes.
Okay. So they get driver's ed, but they get more, don't they?
We do. So we implement our Detroit, like, violence prevention safety instructions class. So they get to interact more with police officers. We teach them a conflict resolution, road rage. We are building relationships with them during these class segments. It gives them a whole encounter with the police department on a different level.
And are you seeing this training affect students' attendance and grades?
Oh, it definitely does. The attendance rate went up 32%. The grades went up 10%. And our behavior violations, which is the best, dropped 81%. They can't miss a day during their program. And also, to get through all three segments, they're still on their probation period with us where they have to come to school. There's no missing days. So the attendance rate did go up. So now that you have our 10th and 11th graders going towards this program, you see the 9th graders want this. They're like, okay, so if their older brother and sister or one of their friends just accomplished their first portion of their driving training, they know their next year, it's an application process. They have to make sure that they're trying to come to school, get the grades, because we want the best to come. You know, we want them to be their best.
How many schools are you in now? So you say you started at Cody.
We are in 5. The Stillman Foundation has given us $150,000 towards our Drive to Thrive program this year. And GM gave $125,000. So this year, that's how we're going to be able to have 275 students this year alone, because the funds that we have between the two of them.
You know, they say it takes a village. Certainly Drive to Thrive is an example of this. You've got partnerships among Detroit Police Department, Detroit Public Schools, the Detroit Youth Violence Prevention Initiative, All-Star Driver Education, the Detroit Public Safety Foundation. That's a lot of stakeholders. Why do you think so many stakeholders are supporting Drive to Thrive?
I think they're realizing the importance of this. The biggest factor was nobody realized the impact that it's having on our generation that's coming. They're at college, they still go there without having a driver's license. Then you have all these companies that's going there for hirement. They're looking at these students, they don't even meet their qualifications because they're not even holding a driver's license. Mm. Not only that, our kids are still driving without a driver's license. They get pulled over, they'll get a ticket driving without a license. That ticket in turn turns into a warrant if they do not pay it. That warrant comes up with fines. So now you got a 16-year-old or 17-year-old driving. They might drop their little brother or sister off at school because they got to get to school. They get to school. They get a ticket. That ticket goes into warrant status. Mm-hmm. Now they're in the system, and they come in the system. It's like a pathway from school to prison. And we're seeing that. We want to stop that. And I believe that everybody is starting to see, like, hey, this is something that's needed. Now I know you have families like on the outskirts, you know, that might be able to pay for their students. Or, for example, you know, I sent my son through his first segment of driver's training because I can afford it. But when you have some of our parents or struggling families who could afford $275 to pay for driver's training when they have a $275 DTE bill, and then those are the types of choices that the parents of the youth are getting faced with.
You are a recruiter. What kind of interest amongst youth do you find in police work in general?
A lot. The main question is always the SRT, which is our, like, SWAT. They say SWAT, but it's our SRT. It's our special response team. A lot of the guys want to go towards that. A lot of females likes the domestic violence portion in our child abuse units. They like to deal with the community, or they might have been involved in situations like that, so they want to make a change. So I get a lot of the females will ask about our domestic violence unit or even our homicide units in K-9. Hmm. Our K-9 unit is definitely another one of everybody's favorites.
So Drive to Thrive is a solid effort to make a career in law enforcement more attainable for these young people. But it is no secret that, and you know this, among some people and some communities, especially communities of color, the police don't have the greatest reputation. So here you are, a recruiter for the Detroit Police Department. How do you address negative images of police when you're sitting there face-to-face talking with young people?
Well, I got to say, I was born and raised in the city as well, and I understand everything that's going around us, but I love my city, and I can tell you, I can speak for a lot of Detroit police officers that we love our city, and I'm going to knock on wood that we don't have those type of problems. We try to have our police department image our city, and that's why we stay within our city, and I'm staying within our city to recruit, because it took somebody to give me this opportunity to do what I'm doing, and now I'm passing it on back to my youth and my generation. We have so many great programs here that connect our community with our Detroit Police Department. Just our community events that's held at each precinct, from just even parties for the children, the Halloween parties, Christmas parties. We do Secret Santa. We just go around and give. We have a sisterhood program that's within the schools, a brotherhood program that's within these schools. We really do try to connect with our community.
Detroit Police Sergeant Star Gonzalez. Sergeant, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having us and for your support. We really appreciate it.
What better way to wrap up the year for Detroit's first responders, police, fire, EMS, than the Above and Beyond Awards? Every year, the Detroit Public Safety Foundation honors Detroit's first responders with Purple Hearts, Valor Awards, and more. With us now, Detroit Police Chief James Craig. Chief, these year-end awards provide kind of an opportunity to look back, to reflect. As you review 2018 overall, Chief, what kind of year has it been for the Detroit Police Department?
Well, as so many, you know, now approaching my sixth year here back in Detroit, probably one of the more profound years when it comes to just the kind of work that our police officers engaged in. And I'm talking about some of the heroic efforts they make, not occasionally, but on a routine basis. We don't always hear about the significant work they do in running towards gunfire, chasing individuals with weapons, putting their own lives in harm's way, rescuing children. Like, I'm speechless. You know, I've been in this job now 41 and a half years, and I don't think there's been another time that I can remember, particularly even when I started into the profession, where our officers are just so heroic. And I certainly am not only proud, but certainly I get a chance to remind Detroiters, both who live and who are in the region, about the just tremendous work that our men and women do every single day.
And when you think of as you say, nearly 6 years now, where you came to Detroit in 2013 to become the chief, what do you feel in your time at the head of this department, what have been some personal points of pride for you?
You know, it's so many. I will tell you, having started my career here, I've always had tremendous faith. I mean, it was here in Detroit that was the foundation for my career. And so returning after so many years, I believe that that foundation still existed. And I came to find out it did exist. And that the men and women here are exposed to so much more when you compare to many of the other major cities across America. You know, I can say it now, having worked in Los Angeles for many years, other departments like Cincinnati, and then talking to my colleagues in other places, Detroit police officers deal with so many crises, whether it's, again, I talked about it earlier, you know, just rescue efforts, armed suspects running towards gunfire, dealing with armed, mentally ill suspects that are barricaded, and more times than not, successful resolutions to those very emotionally charged situations. I don't know of a department that does it quite like we do it. And then on top of that, just the relationship and the bridges that we've built in this community over the last 5 years.
I know that there have been some very difficult moments for you in the department in this, really since the last Above and Beyond Awards. You have lost three officers in the line of duty who will be honored at the awards with posthumous Purple Hearts. What do you want us to know about these three officers?
Well, the thing to remember, the cliche or the phrase that's oftentimes said, we will never forget, I mean that. Certainly I have a staff who has keenly embraced the importance of keeping our heroes' memories alive. And one way to best accomplish that, and one thing that we do here that I know of really no other police department, is that we embrace the families of our fallen heroes so that they're not forgotten. They know what their loved one meant to the city and to their colleagues here in the Detroit Police Department. These are individuals who woke up that morning, donned their uniform to go out in a very selfless way to serve this community with distinction and never came home. And so we want the public to remember that, and more times than not, this is what defines this department. That's a department of excellence.
Chief, how is recruitment going for your team?
You know, many other departments are challenged with recruitment. The one thing for sure, we have continued to hire, even though we don't pay as much as, say, some of our suburban counterparts. But as I oftentimes say, when you create an environment of excitement and opportunity, those are the things that sometimes more than money will attract good people into the organization. And so we've had the good fortune of hiring some of the best in the region across the state. On occasion, we have been able to recruit from other police departments. While we certainly have been the training ground for so many suburban locations where they have poached on us, people want to be Detroit police officers. And I know as I was a young officer joining this profession, I always wanted to work a department that had a great reputation, where you could learn to do police work, where there was tremendous opportunity. And it was through those opportunities that I personally got to see advancement, experience, and eventually reaching my ultimate goal, which was chief of police. Not once, but three times.
Yeah. Chief, what would help you keep those other departments from poaching your officers and poaching those who graduate from the DPT Academy?
Well, you know, I got to give credit to the mayor. You know, the mayor and I are both committed to making sure that we continue to find ways to pay our officers more money. He's committed to it. He doesn't wait to a contract cycle. If financially things are continuing to move in the right direction, he's always willing to open a contract and let's start discussions over finding ways to pay our officers more money. Creating those different job opportunities within the organization, equally important. We are looking at some strategies so that if, in fact, an officer makes that decision to go to some smaller agency, either that officer or that agency should incur the cost
of what it costs Detroit taxpayers to train one of our officers. And that's just the right thing to do. And so we are looking very aggressively to do that. But as important as making sure that our officers who have one of the toughest policing jobs in America, that they're compensated accordingly.
Chief Craig, I don't need to tell you this. It's a national story that among some communities and some people, particularly communities of color, the police don't have a great reputation. So as the chief of Detroit's police department, how do you personally address negative images of police when you're out in the community, especially when you interact with young people?
Well, it's what we do. We have what I consider better than average relationships. We do a lot with our youth community, our young adults. We recognize that they're the future leaders of the city. And so building those relationships are critical. One thing that's very different today that didn't exist, say, 30, 40 years ago, is something called the Internet. If it happens in Los Angeles, California, or it happens in Chicago, it touches Detroit. And certainly any stain by any member of our profession anywhere in the country certainly cast images that affect us as well. But it's not what we do occasionally. It's what we do each and every day. Is this department going to make mistakes? Yes, we are. Do we make mistakes? Of course. We're not perfect, but it's how you respond to them. And I think what's equally important, you know, you hear a lot of conversations surrounding transparency, but what does transparency look like? It just means consistently telling the truth, taking responsibility, and holding people accountable. That's how you diminish the negative impressions of police.
I recently spoke on this program with Grand Rapids Police Chief David Rohinski about what he most wants to get in order to do the kind of police work and community involvement that he really wants to do, and they've heard very clearly from the community they want as well. And at the very top of his wish list, he wanted money to hire more officers. What's at the top of Chief Craig's wish list?
Well, you know, it's multifaceted. I mean, certainly money is a key factor. Retention is key for me. That would probably be one of my top asks. We certainly want to keep our candidate pool vibrant, that will continue to attract the best of the best. But when you're the largest agency in a state, like when I was in California with the LAPD, you also have to be a department of excellence because people want to be part of success. And so one of the things coming in the door I knew I was acutely aware of is the importance of that reputation. And when I look at our executive team, for example, when we had a deputy chief who was sought after in this command is now running the Dallas Police Department, and that's one example, and other members of the executive team who have been sought out to lead other police departments, both small and large. And so that says a lot about the organization. That means a lot. And when you're not asked and people don't inquire and they don't respect the organization, then certainly that transcends down into perceptions. And so I have so many, it's no secret that we're a city that went through bankruptcy, and tremendous work has gone into by this leadership team here in the city of Detroit. Very fortunate for the mayor's commitment and dedication to really make this city a city of excellence. And these things don't happen overnight. When you talk about some of the other dynamics that go on in a city this size, when you look at poverty rates, the fact that we're looking to give people opportunities, that returning citizens are getting opportunities, that the city is becoming safer. When we launched technology and initiatives like Green Light Detroit and the impact that has had on reducing violence, it doesn't mean that our work is over. It just means that we're not sitting back waiting to try to make things happen, but we're doing it. And people see it, and that's what matters.
Detroit Police Chief James Craig, who along with Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan will be at this Thursday's Above and Beyond Awards ceremony honoring Detroit Police, Fire, and EMS with Medals of Valor and with Purple Heart Awards. Chief Craig, it's always great to talk with you, and we want to thank you for taking time for us on Stateside.
Likewise. Look forward to the next time.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.